had an invitation by one of their spokesmen to step out here in the plow dirt. Now, I had been to the plow dirt before. And with all the confidence of a Dominica rooster, I stepped out there in the plow dirt. And before he got ready, I did old hop, skip, and jump on him. And I hit him as hard. I come through South Louisiana with a right hook over the top, caught him on the chin just flush. I mean, I knocked the fire out of him. I'm ready to strut around a little bit, you know.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back to the Hayden, Alabama podcast. I'm Philip.
I'm Shane.
I'm David.
I'm Robin.
And
I'm Mike.
This is Mr. Larry, my father-in-law, and Heavy, we call him, but Mike Gerald. They're friends of mine.
They're friends of Mr. Robin. So we have got up this morning and drove to Philadelphia, Mississippi. And we're here at a hunting camp to do some storytelling. So a little bit of background before we get started. So Mr. Robin reached out to us months ago and just encouraged us and gave us a good word. We've stayed in touch over that time. And today the schedule's finally aligned and we're here for the storytelling we've been talking about for a while. So since you are responsible for this whole thing, Mr. Robin, why don't, it's only right that you lead off with the first story.
All right. We also love to go fishing. And we were setting some lines over in the Delta. And when those catfish ponds flood and they all go in the next ditch, it's excellent fishing. And we were over there and Mr. Larry didn't make this trip. But we were catching so many fish, it was like work. I mean, it was just, it become a burden.
Took all the fun out of it.
Yeah, I mean, it was... It done got late at night, and everybody done got tired and sleepy, and we still had fish to dress. I thought we were just dressing fish. I was shucking them. And,
shucking. Like a corn cob.
That's what I had in my mind.
Well, a group of folks drove up, and by the way, this is a sermon illustration of mine. A group of folks drove up and they said, could they have some fish? I said, well, sure. And they said, we want dress fish. I said, no, I ain't going to give you none of my dress fish.
I worked for them.
I didn't put too much effort into these. Well, it escalated from there and it went to, I had an invitation by one of their spokesmen to step out here in the plow dirt. Now, I had been to the plow dirt before. And with all the confidence of a Dominica rooster, I stepped out there in the plow dirt. And before he got ready, I did old hop, skip, and jump on him. And I hit him as hard. I come through South Louisiana with a right hook over the top, caught him on the chin just flush. I mean, I knocked the fire out of him. And I'm ready to strut around a little bit, you know. So that's worked in previous instances.
Yeah.
That had worked well for me. But that old fellow, this is all he did. He didn't stumble. He didn't bleed. He didn't fall. He just, that's all. Now, the next part of the story was a blur for me because...
It's a lot going on in that circumstance in that little span of time.
I had some eyewitnesses to what happened next, but I couldn't tell you for sure because the next thing I knew, the biggest, strongest, hardest hands wrapped around my head in the plow dirt, and every time I'd exhale, I'd see a little puff of dirt. He said, "We're gonna get some of your fish." I said, help yourself. And I live to fish again.
Live to tell it again.
And I use that for a sermon illustration about when Jesus said, come and take my yoke upon you. I say, don't fight your yoke. Don't fight your yoke.
Yeah.
Because what I got pales in comparison when you fight the yoke of God.
You could.
That's powerful.
you could think for just a second, it changed your mind real quick. You decided you was going to just give him all your dress.
All he wanted, he was welcome to him. If he just let go of my head.
Are you in trouble? Well, we hope you're not. But just in case you are, we know a good lawyer. Whitney Island here in Hayden, Alabama has law services. Or maybe if you're not from Hayden, I'm sure she'd be happy to hear from you. So check her out at islandlaw.com. We appreciate Whitney and her sponsoring the show.
And Mr. David, won't you? So you are a retired state trooper.
28 years.
And you've written at least three books.
Yes, that's my retirement hobby.
Retirement hobby. So we've got this one here is When the Big Coon Walks, Hunting the Best of Times and People. And then this is Mississippi State Trooper.
Clever title.
Yeah, it's kind of tells where you are. And look at this young man on the front of it.
You think I've changed?
Not at all.
Thank you.
And then T-Bone Road. And so those are three books, and y'all can find those. We'll link those up. But we've read some of these stories because Mr. Robin here, Brother Robin, was kind enough to send them to us pre this recording. And we've hooped and hollered over them. So I can't wait for you to tell some of them. Tell some of your favorite ones for us.
We're on fishing stories. Back in 1990, I moved from South Mississippi to Columbus to be closer to home. And met a couple at church, Mark Young, his wife Stephanie, great people. They had moved with his family from Crossett, Arkansas, deep in Arkansas. Worked for Weyerhaeuser, great people. And Mark told me one day, he said, "Well, take you jug fishing." Well, I'd never been jug fishing. I'd always heard of it, but I love to fish. But we were raised up fishing in the creek or in the stock pond, and we didn't have boats and motors and any of that. Those were high-tech people that had that stuff. And so he came over and picked me up one Saturday afternoon, and he said, "We got to have live bait," which made sense to me. And he had a cast net. I said, "Where are we going to get our bait?" He said, "We're going to the country club. They've got ponds over there." I said, "Mark, I don't believe that they want us at the country club. I don't
reasonable fish. Assumption.
Reasonable assumption. I've never been to a country club. I've never fished out of a boat with a motor. I don't use live, you know, but I don't think they want us at the country club."
Yeah.
He said, "Oh man." He has a good distinctive accent. "Oh man, my mom and daddy are members over there. And we come over there and mom and daddy golf and they know us. And they won't mind at all." And I thought, "Well, I don't know about that." But I was a guest. And he had a four-wheel drive truck. I hadn't been in one of those before. My friends didn't have high-tech stuff. So we got in the four-wheel drive truck. We went over to the country club. Put up there like we owned the place. Went in there and got his mommy and daddy's golf cart. Threw our five-gallon buckets and cast net in that. And went to cast net in the little ponds while people were golfing around out there. We got to about the third pond, and we were wearing them out, people. If you need some live bait, if you can get into the ponds at the country club you're in,
get it.
Yes, sir. There are plenty of red bellies in those. Wearing them out, catching little bass, keeping them. And I looked up the hill toward the clubhouse, and I saw this little woman with her little short legs, and she was... I had never seen her, heard about her, knew nothing about her, but I knew who she was and what she was and what she was fixed to do. She was coming in that hill working those little short legs.
On a steady trot.
Straight to us. And she put us out of the country club. She explained that you don't come to the country club on Saturday afternoon and catch fish. So we got our fish. She let us keep them.
Oh, that's nice.
Oh, yes, sir. It was plus.
Yeah.
We got a little scolding out of it. But we went. And so we headed over to Columbus Lake, where it backs up from the lock and dam. And we pulled up with our live bait. And his friends had gathered. And over there parked was a boat, a bass boat. Had a steering wheel. I was very impressed. Couldn't wait. And they were grilling hamburgers and hot dogs and drinking cold beer. And I'm not a drinker, so I sat and ate. And they told stories. And after a while, we got our country club bait, and we got in the boat and threw jugs out. You've been there, done that. And so we'd go check jugs, come back, and they'd drink beer and cook. And then it got late at night, and they said, need to take them up. And I wanted to go. So Mark and I got in the boat, off we went to the, picked our jugs up. By that time, we were on the far side of the lake. And when he got ready to come back, he gapped that thing back as fast as it would go. And we were holding little flashlights. They were at the front of the boat. And I don't know anything about boats, but I know that you aren't supposed to overdrive your headlights. You know what that is. You got to drive at a speed where you can stop in the distance you can see. And I thought, if there's a big tree out here floating around, we're going to wreck. And we were scooting across that water wide open. I don't know what size motor it was. And all of a sudden, we came up on this huge flock of Canada geese. Mm. And they were right there. And he never touched a break. He just...
That's probably because they ain't got one.
And in that brief moment, all I could visualize was those little legs underwater, all of them. Yeah. I knew they were working furiously.
They was pedaling.
It was too late. All you heard was, bump, 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 bump. I guess they were
hanging around on the outside.
Never looked back. I turned around, threw the light, dead geese.
Goodness
everywhere. Gracious. And I thought, I told Mark, I said, weren't we going to get the geese? He said, you can't explain that when you get to the bank. No, you just left. So we left the geese, went back, loaded our stuff, and went home. And that was the only time I went fishing with Mark.
Mark was a one and done.
One and done. I don't think he went back to the country club for fish, but it one and done on that. It was memorable, say the least. Great guy. Fished, hunted with him a good bit.
Mark sounds like some characters we know back home.
Yeah, we've got a couple of Marks back at the house.
Same type people.
That's fantastic. That's on the lake. That's a good word. I mean, you gave some sage advice. Don't outrun your headlights on the water because your brake don't work real good.
Brakes are non-existent.
We went hunting together one time. Or do you want me to?
No, go ahead.
Invited
this
to go
Mark.
Hunting. Mark.
So you just only went fishing with him one time?
I hunted with him a couple of times, too.
Okay.
He's a great hunter, he worked at Weyerhaeuser. And when you go 45 South Columbus, turn on Weyerhaeuser Road, Highway 792, it's woods on the right. Weyerhaeuser owns all this. And we were hunting in that little stretch of woods. Saw nothing, killed nothing. Came out of the woods and from straight road, it's a huge soybean field all the way up there to Weyerhaeuser. Weyerhaeuser's on the other side of the road. When we came out of the woods, we were riding a Honda three-wheeler, a big red, which was the thing back then, maybe before your time, but we were on big red.
I caught the tail end of it. They're fun.
Yeah. And we jumped four deer. And so we naturally did what we ran them. They ran across that open field, and we were gapped back. We were right on them. We ran them and ran them and ran them. And finally, we came to a power line across it. And when we hit the power line, they hit the water, and it flooded the motor. And the deer went all the way down to the far corner, and they were so tired, they didn't even go into the woods. They were just standing there, huffing and puffing. But we shot at them, of course, while they were
of
running.
Of course. Yeah.
I'm sorry, I forgot that.
We did shoot
a couple of times. But when they finally stopped after being run and shot at, they just stood there and opened. And I was doing a lot of shooting back then, and it used to be a high-power rifle club. And I wrapped my sling up and propped up like I was at the range and aimed up over the back, her back, and touched the trigger. And Mark said, "You hit that deer." And I said, "Really?" And he said, "Yeah." So he went to working on the four-wheeler, and I walked down to the across the field. And there was a little ditch there. And there the deer lay dead as a mackerel. And I thought, well, look at me.
Mm-hmm.
And I walked it back.
Look what I've done.
Look what I have done. So it's 400 steps. Some of them were a little shorter, probably. You know, I think I might have shortened up a few to make it even 400. But, you know, right, something like that. So after that, as long as I lived in Columbus, if we got around guys talking hunting, it would eventually get a little opening for me. And I would cue Mark up and I would say, "Oh, that's the longest non-supported shot you've ever seen there, Mark, on a deer." Mark would say, "Oh, yeah." He'd always do it just right. He'd tell the story and say, 400 yards, big steps for him. He said, "Yeah," and he'd brag at me a little bit, and I
poke your chest out.
Yes, I felt good about it.
Uh-huh.
So we left Columbus, moved. I didn't see Mark for years. And then I came to a baseball game at New Hope. That's near Columbus. And Mark's son had grown up. I had a son then. They were both pitchers. My son pitched for Louisville. And Mark had turned gray-haired, but he was still the same guy. And we reconnected. And a bunch of his friends were there. And we got to talk about deer hunting. And I, you know, my pride got me. And I said, well, Mark, what's the longest shot you've ever seen made on a deer? And he says, what are you talking about? I said, you know, man, the soybean.
The cue.
The soybean field, yeah. The deer at the end, you know. And he said, oh, yeah, y'all, it must have been 150, 200 yards. Oh, man. Story dead. Yeah, he threw me under the blood. I thought, man, so my pride went up, down, gone.
Usually stories get better. Over time, he made it get worse.
He killed me right there.
Oh, really? Man.
Right there.
Yeah, last time I've seen him.
All right, Mr. Robin, I know you got another one.
Well, strangely enough, it's about fishing, too. My father-in-law and I took my youngest son, Buck, out to the 10-time waterway, and we set out some trot lines. We used to do a lot of that. And we set all the lines on one side of the river, except for one we set on the other side. And the 10-time's not a terribly wide river, but it's pretty deep. And it has barge traffic on it. Those barges are dangerous. Heavy used to pilot them things. And they throw a big wake, and they ain't got no brakes either. And they're huge. And we were crossing the river to go to our last line. We had caught a few fish. My son, Buck, was about three or four, but he couldn't talk real. He kind of baby talked, had a little speech impediment like I do. And we got in the middle of the river, and that 9.9 let me down. It just quit on it. Well, I went to pulling the rope naturally.
That's called a sitting duck, Mr. Robin.
Yes, sir. Because about that time, here comes a barge around the corner. Well, at this moment, the cranking efforts increased dramatically. And so I went to pull real hard, and I pulled the rope out. And that barge blowing horn, bump, like I didn't see him.
Yeah,
like you wanted to be. Yeah, yeah. Coming down the river that's narrow.
Now, that's what we trained to do before we run over.
when we know we're fixing to create a death, that's what we're told to do.
It's a liability.
Save the pilot from going to prison for killing some people that's too stupid to get out of the way. That's why
he had an inoperable motor. It wasn't stupid. It wasn't, Mr. Robin.
No. So in a moment of genius, I took my bootlace out, plopped the coil handle off, wrapped it around the flywheel, and tried to crank it again. And at this point, my little son, speech impediment, baby talk, said, Daddy, who don't did that motor train? We're going to be in heaven and on the news.
Simultaneously.
Next time I wrapped around, she hit. We turned around, went to our good side of the river, and went to the house.
Just left that other line hanging, didn't you? Yeah. It might have been loaded
with
fish.
Maybe still over there. That limb may be jerking right now.
Waiting on you to come get that big catfish off there.
Yeah.
They wasn't a catfish in the Tom Bigby River worth that.
No.
It was amazing. It just speech impediment and all. It didn't matter, huh? He
communicated
had to get
some clearly with me.
Just like that barge captain was communicating clearly with you. If you don't move, you're going to be run over.
Yeah, I fished with Robin, and stuff like that seems to follow him around. Mm. It's not like it's a one-time thing. I think that's just his lifestyle.
It's a pattern.
There's a pattern there.
I've got a cousin, I was telling you about him earlier, that we'd go airhead hunting with, you know. We went fishing with him one night up in the deep water by the house, and one of his favorite things was haints. You ever heard of a haint?
Oh, yeah.
I know y'all heard haints, right? So we were fishing, and we had a little trolling motor on a little flat bottom boat, and I was casting over on one side, and Larry Joe was casting on the other, and I was in charge of the trolling motor. He was on the front of the boat. Well, I was on the back, and I was trying to keep us going forward, you know, where we could fish. So I'd have to hit the motor every now and then just to straighten us back up. And I hit the motor and Larry Joe went to yanking. Oh, I got a big one. I got a big one. And then the more he yanked, the more his rod went down. He said, I think it's a Hane. I said, what are you talking about? Well, I'm steering the boat and his rod's just a going down in the water, you know, just a pulling line. I got a Hane on. I said, Larry Joe, what are you yelling about? And I finally got the boat, the motor, or the boat straightened back up. Well, I turned the trolling motor off. Well, his rod stopped pulling. He looked at me and I looked at him. He said, that wasn't a Hane, it was you. I said, I didn't tie your boat or your line around the motor. I said, the Hane might have tied it around the motor.
This goes back a ways. I was a young man. I was 29, 30. No, this was 32. And I hadn't been moved back from Louisiana too long. And I had a good job. I had a good job and I was living by myself, single. And the job I had working on the river boats allowed me anywhere from 2 to 4 weeks off at a time. So Grunt and I used to turkey hunt every day. If we wasn't hunting them, we were scouting them, Alabama, Missouri, different. But anyway, I had been somewhere around town, not too far, and I came back to my old house about 6 or 7 miles out in the county. And I said, well, I'm going to read a little bit before I get to bed. Go to bed. I was laying on the couch reading. I forget what it was. And I got the worst feeling. Excuse me. Hackle stood up on my neck.
Hank's trying to keep you telling that story now.
Yeah. Hackle stood up on the back of my neck. I mean, just got goosebumps on me. And though I hadn't seen or heard or smelt anything yet, I'm enough like a critter myself that I went to escape or defend myself. My first move was to run in there by the bedroom and grab my shotgun. But I'd no more than reach for it when something told me, no, it won't work on this. Your gun ain't gonna stop this. And I was in an awful way. I was scared. I won't say the scaredest, but it's up there in the top five because I've had some exciting times in my life. Anyhow, it wasn't but about 9 o'clock. I jumped in my truck. I pulled my shoes on, jumped in my truck, and I went over to Larry's house. Mainly, I went over there to be around, to be near Miss Brenda. We call her Dee, his wife, because she was a thorough Christian. And he wasn't as bad as me, but he wasn't nothing. He wasn't nothing but a sinner. He is devil bait, I'll put it that way. Anyhow, he was working the motor plant then. I'm talking about like the mid-80s, you know. And he come to the door with his drawers and T-shirt on. And when he opened it, I didn't wait for him to invite me in.
You coming on in.
He said, what's the matter with you, boy? And I said, there's something in my house. I don't know what it is. I can't. And his wife, Brenda, come out in her house coat, and she took one look at me and laughed and said, the devil's ain't after you, ain't he heavy? Said, I've told you about your heathen, whoremongering, sinful ways, and it's done come home to you now, and you're scared, ain't you? I said, yeah, I'm scared. I said, I don't know what I'm going to do. I guess I'll stay here with y'all tonight. And they told me I could, but Brenda said, you need to take your house back. You've got to at one point or another. You got to go back over there. And you can run them off if you want to. And
She said, I can run them off. I said, come on, get in the truck.
You get in the truck. We'll pop all in. Let's go get it.
And I'll take you over there and I want you to run them off for me. She just laughed, said, I could, but it'd be better if you done it yourself. Said, have you got a Bible? And I said, yeah, I do, but it's in the house and there were things at.
Can I borrow yourn?
Yeah, and I mean, I'm fat and old and all now, but I was much of a man when I was in my 30s. Mm-hmm. And I was much of a scared man that night. And she said, I got one here you can take with me. Take with you. A little Bible about like this. I think I still got it. I don't know if I ever brought it back. But then I start to get embarrassed. And my main thing is, let's let them go on to bed and you sleep in your truck or something tonight. You ain't got it. But there was something about it sort of like I had been challenged or insulted. And I thought of that song, Ain't No Hank Gonna Run Me Off, back in the 50s or 60s.
Yeah.
So anyhow, this about 2 o'clock in the morning, I made it back into my driveway. Now, there was a tank of gas in several hours. I went up and down that road, peeping, trying to see something.
Turkey neck.
Yeah. Trying to build up my
courage.
Yeah, and finally, I just said, heck with it. I pulled up in my driveway and I got out with that Bible in my hand. And like Brenda had told me to do, I started praying. And just within seconds, the burden was off of me. I felt better. I felt like it's time to attack now. You know, you done got your head back up. I went in the house scolding them haints in the name of Jesus, told them I was true. I'm an old sinner, but I am a child of God, and there's no place in my home or heart from you. So get on out from here, all of you, and don't come back. Well, suddenly I wasn't scared of my house no more. There wasn't no more boogers in there. So I got brave. I got all out in the yard.
I'm gonna run them out of the. I got them out of the house. Let me get them out of the yard.
I was gonna run them off for places. It's Mr. Lowry Lundy's land, the old house I rented from him. And I got out there and I was all around threatening them, shaking that Bible at them. I went back in the house and I wasn't going turkey hunt the next day. I had a dentist, a doctor appointment or something I had to go to. So I said, I need to get some sleep. I'm going to feel awful tomorrow. It's only a couple hours before daylight. You need to lay down anyhow. You ain't going to sleep, but lay down anyway. Rest your eyes. I laid down there on that bed, put that Bible there by my shotgun on the nightstand. And I believe I went to sleep as soon as my head hit the pillow. And I woke up about 8:30 or 9. It's warm. I've been sleeping with my windows open at night. Birds are singing, cows lowing on another beautiful spring day. And so I've always been leery. Two things I had never believed a whole lot in was wild black panthers in Mississippi and haints. Now I believe in the haints, and though I hadn't seen a black panther, and if we got any, it is very few. But haints definitely exist. And if you ever get them after you,
you better get your Bible and the Lord on your side.
That's the best thing.
That's the best thing for it. Do y'all remember?
The devil can't stand it, you know. I heard an old story about a Indian boy is fixing to become a man. And one of his rites of passage was to spend the night in the woods by himself. Young teenage boy. Well, his daddy led him off down the woods, long way from camp. And he got there just right at dark. So his daddy went over there and looked around, kicked around a little bit at the base of a tree. So you stay, sit down here, stay here all night. I'll see you in the morning. Well, the young man did, and he was all right for a couple of hours. Then that quiet got scary. His imagination went to work, and he could see all the boogers out there just peeping around trees and slipping up on him. He was terrified. Boy's heart's racing. He's balled up in a knot like a whooped dog. But then after a few hours over in the east, he went to seeing a little bit of light. Little bit of light. And it went to warming up a little bit as the sun started just to peep over the trees. That sun felt good, and he went to dozing off. And he'd only dozed off a few minutes and opened his eyes, and there was his daddy sitting about 15 or 20 feet away looking at him. And he said, "Where did you come from? How did you get so close to me? I didn't even hear you." His daddy said, "I never left." And that's...
Or right here the whole time.
Yeah.
That's what them daddies do.
That's what they're good for.
Well, yeah. I think of the good Lord when I hear it.
Yeah.
Because
yeah.
Even the best old earthly daddy can fail you. Yeah. I failed my boy before. But that one's never failed.
Good Lord ain't going to.
No.
I've always loved to squirrel hunt, steel hunt. And I'd been to Missouri turkey hunting a lot of times, and there's a lot of squirrels up there in the Mark Twain Forest. And so I've been up there several times squirrel hunting, one time with having some more friends. But my wife got to wanting to go somewhere. I said, "Well, we'll go to Missouri squirrel hunting. They got some little cabins down on the Big Piney River. Nice place.
Nice romantic.
Yeah.
Romantic place.
About like
what we're sitting in here.
No, it ain't quite this nice. Oh. But anyhow, I had a Remington 1100 and
good
my
guns.
Wife had shot a gun before. She'd killed deer. And I said, "You going to hunt too?" She said, "Yeah, I'll hunt. I'll go with you." And so I got her to shoot that 1100 with light load shells, naturally. But if any of y'all squirrel hunt, you know light load shells ain't fitting for a squirrel. You need you some of them Remington long brass number 6 shot. Mm-hmm. So that's what I bought to go squirrel hunting. Well, we went up there that morning. Well, that week, got up there that morning and drove over to the place. Robin and Heavy both know where it's at, down that steep hill mountain. And we walked down it in the dark, fixing to go up the mountain to another mountain. And nature got the bump the call to me. And I had on a pair of coveralls. And there was a den tree. I knew it was there from turkey hunting. I said, "Now, you watch that tree right there." And I'd fill that 1100 up with them number 6 heavy load. I said, "You watch that tree right there." And I said, "There'll probably be a squirrel come out in a minute. And when it does, you shoot it." And I said, "I'm going to get off over here.
Take care of some business.
Take care of some business.
See had on coveralls."
Well, I got over to the side about 20 yards off. A little bit I hear say, "There's a squirrel. A squirrel, what did I do?" I said, "You shoot him." Well, instead of putting the gun on the shoulder, she puts it under her arm. And she shoots. And it spins her around. And to my amazement, she shoots again about 2 foot from where I'm sitting. Blows leaves and dirt all over. Well, I can't get up fast enough with them coveralls on. So I just dive for them around my ankles. Man. Would you have it to know, here comes another shot. Boom. Leaves went all over the place. Dirt. Well, I make another big dive. Boom. Till that gun is empty and I'm tired of diving. I'm give out covered in leaves and dirt.
Among other things.
Among other things.
Among other things.
And she said, I'm ready to go back to the truck now. She said, if I killed you, ain't no way I could have got you up that hill. I said, no, I'm going squirrel hunting. I come as far to go squirrel hunting. But I took it. What I did, I took all the shells away from it, but I made her tote that gun up in mountains all day. Yeah.
I would have said, I'm ready to go to the truck, too.
No, I come to squirrel.
He kept that to himself.
Bless. All right, Mr. Dave, you said you had a dog story.
Yeah. Back in mid-70s, I had a friend. I had him for years. Jim McMillan. Jim from Louisville. Great guy he was. He's deceased now. He was in the National Guard for decades. He had a little quiet voice, never raised his voice. A really nice guy. But there around 76 or so, he somehow got the keys to the shed at the National Guard where they apparently had the artillery simulators. And so every once in a while around Louisville or up at High Point Community up there, you'd hear one go off and nobody knew what it was, but it was a big talk, you know. I knew where it was coming from. It was Jim. Those things, I don't know if you're familiar with them. It's a satchel type deal. You heat blown them. You pull it, you throw it, and it makes, goes like a bomb coming in. And it is as loud as it sticks of dynamite. It's a powerful thing because it's mimicking artillery coming in. You got to get it away from me. Well, Jim, they had to get together at his sister Barbara's place down the road. And Jim slipped out of the house. He thought it would be humorous to go out there and throw an artillery simulator out in the front yard and little pine trees and shake the windows. So he goes out in the front yard, and I asked him, he told me the story right out of his mouth. I went out there. Anyway, he pulls a pin, throws it out in the yard, and Barbara had a dog named Bullet. He was a big old German shepherd, and she had taught it to fetch. And he threw it out there, and he said Bullet went and grabbed it. And Jim was trying to stop it and run from it, and Bullet wasn't listening, and Bullet died there on the spot, and his sister sort of got mad at him about it. And Jim quit telling the story. And he told me, he said, and that was the last time I throwed a simulator.
That was a good reason to.
Yeah.
Good reason to stop.
The reason they keep them things under lock and key.
Yeah, they ain't for everybody, are they?
Yeah. I called his nephew last night to get the name. I'd forgotten Bullet's name. And of course, Chris was just a little boy then. And he said, it was he talks like his uncle said, It was a traumatic experience for all of us.
For all involved.
I bet it was.
Now, Heavy, you over there, you said you got a dog running story, and I'm interested in hearing that one.
This was probably 1971. I'm 14, 15 years old. We didn't have many deer in Neshoba County then. Most people wanted a deer hunt belonged in a camp over in Kemper County. And we hunted with dogs and shotguns back then. And I know all y'all are, but for anybody that might hear this, it's not familiar with dog hunting. The idea is to surround a certain area, say 100 or 200 acre plot of timber or thickets. And you come through there with a pack of dogs. And back then, we was running black and tans, blue ticks, and walkers, mostly the walker. They had a good dog, but you better catch him when he crosses the stand line. He'll be in the next zip code.
Next county.
Yeah. And you can holler him all you want to, and he ain't going to
go. He go and go instead of him.
Anyhow, a lot of times they would use us young men as drivers. Whether we're walking or on a horse, occasionally we'd use a horse, if depending on the terrain. Well, this was going to be a walking drive, and we were going right behind our camp, and the standers would be north and making like a U. So deer ought not be able to get out of it without being shot at. Well, we had several dogs missing, and nobody had took time to go around to the other camps. We didn't have nobody else's dogs in. If we did, we went looking for hours, knew we were going to a camp. We'd go on and throw theirs in, give him a ride home. Anyway, we were out there loading up dogs. Mr. Billy Green was one of my neighbors. He's gone now, but he was a good fella. Sort of like a father figure to me. Well, we had two or three we had pulled out of there that I was going to take that morning. And there was a guy I'm just going to call his first name, Joe. He wasn't a preacher then, but he later made one here in the county, and a great one he was. But at the time, he weren't no preacher. Anyhow, the rule, I guess, I don't know if it's spoken or written, but most grown adult men brought at least one dog. Some of them, two or three, some of them would bring a pack. And we'd like to run one pack in the morning, another pack at evening. But like I say, we were short of dogs. Well, Mr. Joe had a big, beautiful walker dog. I mean, he was pretty and he was friendly. One problem, Joe's little boys and girls, little children had loved on him and rode him so much that he wasn't fit for nothing.
But pet.
Yeah. And it was well known amongst all the drivers. He's always under your feet. You could be smelling the deer, your dog's just jumping. He wouldn't even go with him. He'd stay under your feet or under the horse's feet. Had to kick him every once in a while, get him out of the way. Went to pull him out, and I said, I ain't taking that thing. He won't do nothing. He won't hunt. And his owner, Joe, was standing there. And Billy Green said, shut up. You'll take what I tell you to take. So I was standing there. Frowning, and it embarrassed Joe, me talking about his dog like that. It's the truth. He said, Mike, if he don't run this morning, leave him in the woods. Bring me his collar. I said, all right. So we took him and him, and we probably had a half a dozen dogs size him. I waited for everybody to get on the stand. I took the dogs, headed out. Sure enough, we ain't won a quarter of a mile, and they jumped hot. Just, he's standing there looking off out of the way, look at me like, did you see anything? I didn't see anything. And I kicked him. I said, get on out there. Somebody killed a deer. I don't know what it was or nothing like that or who it was. Somebody killed a deer. I'd heard shooting over there on the stand line. So all I had was old Joe's dog with me. So I was just going to walk on back to the camp. That was closer than going all the way to the stand line. There's an old black man live right down the road from us. I think they called him Nevis. But he was a good old fella. He'd bring us turnip greens and collards when we was up there hunting and keep eye on our camp. We give him deer meat and he'd come hang out sometime, cook for us. Well, I come out in his yard and he had a well that had some of the coldest, sweetest tasting, best tasting water. And I never missed the opportunity to get me some of it when I come through his yard. I come walking out. And old Nevis sitting over there in his little old chair up under a China berry tree, had them little pipe stem legs crossed. He was ancient. He had to be in his 80s then. He saw me and that dog. He said, yeah, sir. I said, that's a fine looking dog you got there with you. And I said, you want him? I said, I was supposed to have killed him, but I didn't have the heart. Two or three times I aimed that shotgun at him and I couldn't do it. He said, oh, no, I ain't get start no trouble taking somebody's dog. I said, I wished you would because I was supposed to kill him and they're going to get on to me for not doing it. Well, if you don't think nobody will get mad, I said, you need to tie him or put him in a pen. We're going to break camp and leave in a couple of days. Camp wasn't but maybe a quarter mile away. All right, well, he got an old plow line, which was just a rope about as big as your little finger. and tie it on to the dog, put it around his neck. I took the collar off and stuck it in my hunting coat. And I said, Nevis, I'm going to walk out here in the woods onto the camp, and I'm going to shoot. And I'm going to tell him I killed this dog. I'm going to lie to him and tell him I killed him. Well, I got out there and put me a squirrel shot in my gun, shot up in the air in the ground or something where I couldn't hurt nothing. And shouldered my gun. I come walking out. It's on up in the morning, like 10 o'clock. And they got that deer they killed, hung up, skinning it, probably a doe or spike or something. And I walked straight to Mr. Joe, the owner of the dog, reached in my old hunting coat and pulled that collar out and said, yeah. And he said, was that you that shot? I said, yeah. He said, boy, Kelly heard him. He said, I'll go get you a shell. I said, that's all right. I killed him with bird shot, shot him right over the eye up close. Okay. Made it sound
gruesome. That's terrible.
Detailed.
And some of the men are sitting over in that, over there playing cards. They like in their 20s and 30s. And there's a couple of them older that was in World War II. And they looked at each other like, that dang boy is cold-blooded. Because everybody's talking about killing him, you know, killing that dog. All right. So went on to eat dinner and rested a minute and got ready to make the afternoon drive. And y'all know all the sound, tailgates slamming and hollering at dogs and dogs fighting. And I heard somebody say, look yonder. Here comes that walker up the driveway, and he was stretched out in that old rotten piece of plywood dragging the ground with him. And old Joe was so tickled to see him, he run over and slapped his chest, says, come on, son, come on now. The dog jumped up on Joe, and he was loving on him. And Mr. Arnold Barrier, we had two presidents at that camp. He was one of them. He was good friends with all my folks. Called people Sugar Boy. He said, Sugar Boy, you told me you shot that dog, but it looked to me like you tried to hang him and done a poor job. I know now it was awful funny to him.
Yeah.
I said, Mr. Arnold, I didn't have the heart to do it. And the other president, Mr. Johnny Hancock, who was never was to me, but he was capable of doing mean, old man mean stuff if he got mad at you. And I said, I didn't have the heart to do it. And he says, none of these others did too. So y'all quit putting this young'un up to doing something you ain't got the belly to do yourself.
Yeah.
In Sturgis, Mississippi, at the hardware store in the wintertime, old men gathered up to talk there. There was one older gentleman, he was in his 90s. He was actually a World War I veteran. I was just thrilled to be able to sit down and talk to him. And he said one day, he said, yeah, when we went to basic training down there at Camp Shelby, said they never could figure out how to punish them boys from Alabama. Of course, the boys from Alabama probably told the same thing about the boys from Mississippi. Yeah. He said they put them on bread and water. So that was more food than they got at home. So they make them sleep in a barn. So that's nicer than the house they were raised up in. Said they finally figured out how to punish them. I was on the edge of my seat and I said, what'd they do? What'd they do? He said, they put a pair of boots on one like to buck themselves to death.
They used to wear shoes on it.
No.
Well, I'll tell you what's better than a dog for driving deer. Tear gas.
No.
Monkey. I saw that. I've been watching your podcast. No, it wasn't a monkey.
Tear gas, huh?
Tear gas. I always thought, how would tear gas do for running deer?
Never crossed my mind.
Never crossed your mind. That's what most people say.
Yeah.
But there's no law against it that I can find. And if it's not against the law, that it must be legal. So I think I'm on good ground here. Mm-hmm. But I happen to have several canisters of tear gas. And I thought about this for years. And then one day, I'm going to do it. And it was late in the fall, leaves were dry, and there's a cutover on the side of the four-lane highway near my house. And we own the land to the south of it. And I thought, the wind's coming from the north. I can go down the four-lane and drive his deer. So I enlisted the help So I enlisted the help of an unnamed close relative, and I posted him on a hill, an open hardwood that we owned. And I thought, I will drive this strip of cutover, and it was thick. It had been cut over 2 or 3 years before. I thought, my tear gas. And so I pulled out of the four lane, and I wait until there's no traffic in the northbound lane, and I go down the northbound lane southbound until I get to the cutover, and pull the pin on the tear gas and cast it out in the cutover. Then I gas that big bear and go about 50, 60 yards, grab another canister, look back, and woods are on fire. And I thought, oh my gosh, you know, the wind's blowing toward the, so it wasn't our land, by the way.
Of course not.
They owned this little strip there, you know, but we owned all the land. But anyway, that's just the way it was. Yes, I turned around and went back up there. Broke me off a pine top, and I waited in those briars, flailing away, and nobody stopped to help. Mm-hmm. Probably thought I was a hero trying to put out a forest fire. Flailing away, and it starts spreading in a little half-moon pattern. I finally got it beat out. I was sweating bullets and frustrated, and I thought, I better get my can before I get out of here. I don't want to do that. So I ran over it and picked it up. And it put second-degree burns off. You know, you remember how the Branch Davidian compound burned down the FBI through the tear gas? That's the first thing I thought. That's the way they burned out the Branch Davidians. I learned something. I dropped it, and I went to stomping on it because I couldn't pick it up. I didn't want to leave the evidence because I felt so bad about it. So I stomped it into the mud, jumped from my four-wheeler, and went to the house. And I asked my stander, I said, did you see any deer? He said, they all came out of there and said, I never raised my gun. They just came by at a dead run. So I gave my tear gas away that I had left. I thought, once is enough. We're good one time.
I'm going to tell you, the most important thing about hunting and fishing and trapping and really life is relationship.
Right.
They going to last a lot longer than that 6-point you missed or that big bass that blew up on the frog or whatever. It's relationships. First of all, relationship to the Lord. Second, your family, starting with your wife. And hold on, they're worth the effort. They are worth the effort.
Yeah, that's a good word. You remember that.
Yeah. As Sarge told me, we were talking, and we got talking about my cousin Kim had passed away, we both hunted with, and Jim McMillan. And Sarge said, you know, when I got activated in 92 or 94 for Desert Storm, he said, Jim McMillan, they were both in the guard together. And he said, we were supposed to leave out. They were both single men then. He said, we were supposed to leave out for Camp Shelby the next morning early. And he said, your cousin Kim, that, you know, we all had hunted with all our lives. He said, he called me up and said, Sarge, I shot a deer down in the bottoms. I can't find it and need some help. He said, dadgum, you know, it sounds like Kim. He said, pick up Jim and y'all come down here and help me. He said, I went by Jim's, you know, Jim, Kim, need some help. So off we went down to the bottom, which to leave the next day. So we drove down all through the woods, got to the bottom, broke out into the big field, looked across there, there's a big bonfire, a grill set up, drinks and snacks. They were grilling steaks, saying goodbye. Good friend of
mine. Good friends.
Yeah. Winds me up. But you're right. Hunting is about relationship and everything else is, but good friends to hunt with and come around and like tell stories and talk and make new friends like y'all.
That's right.
I've enjoyed this.
I have too. And before we go, I just want to ask you, so Mr. Robin, really Brother Robin, been a pastor for a long time, and we kind of sprinkled that in a little earlier. But our most watched episode is about preachers and the stories that they tell. Do you have anything before we go from your ministry that would just tickle us? Things that's happened to you, a good story or anything?
I got one.
All right,
is that it?
I'm going to write a book. You know you pastor a country church twin.
And it would be slam full.
Yeah. You know you pastor a country church when you have professional wrestlers on the prayer list.
Amen.
Pray for Killer Carl Cox as he takes on Junkyard Dog this week.
Is that serious? Is that serious?
Yes.
Oh, man, that's incredible.
Say that again. Who is facing out on the Junkyard Dog?
Killer Carl Cox.
Oh, Killer Carl.
Killer Carl done got old.
Killer Carl might.
Gotta pray for him.
Killer Carl might sprain something like that 16 gauge.
I met him. Our children go to the same church together. My son, daughter-in-law, his daughter, son-in-law. And they're friends, and we met at grandkids' games. And I'm sitting there, and he comes walking by after it's over and says, introduces himself and said, I read one of your hunting books and said, I'm moving to a church in your community and said, we're going to hunt together. And I thought, give me a break, man.
Yeah, who is this fella?
I've never met you before. You just go walk.
Take you to my hunting spot.
Take you to my hunting spot, my honey hole. And darn if we didn't. And, you know, when you get our age, my age, your hunting friends start passing away. And you get to where you're just going to hunt by yourself.
You run out of time to make long friends.
And you...
What is it? You like run out of time to like... old friends. You run out of time to make old friends. You got time to make new friends.
That's right. You need to make new friends, and you've got to extend a hand. And if somebody comes to you, you've got to take that. Yeah. You just can't get in your little shell. And I've got another friend that I've made, Sam Tyler, and they moved here from New Orleans. I've never met him, and he wants, you know, and made great friends. And you've got to keep that in mind as you get older, to always be ready to make a new friend and have a new experience and do different things. So, yes, that's part of life.
Well, we've had a lot of fun in Philadelphia, Mississippi today telling stories with you fellas. We're at a fine place and a wonderful hunting cabin, and we've been taken back a lot of years and shared some all kinds of experiences. You know, we're not going to say which ones would make the final cut, but anyway, it's been fun, and we appreciate y'all inviting us out. But that's going to do it this week at the Hayden Alabama Podcast. I'm Philip.
I'm Shane.
I'm David.
I'm Robin.
Bye.
And we'll see you guys next week.